Before we start, we just wanted to let you know that this episode contains discussion about death, mental illness, bereavement, grief, and dead bodies. A full list of content warnings is available in the podcast description. We also discuss the film Hereditary in detail, so if you haven't yet watched it, there will be spoilers. Don't say we didn't warn you. Hello, and welcome to the second edition of Panic Pixie Scream Girls, a podcast about horror and anxiety from Holly and Becky. And today we are going to talk about the film Hereditary.
Hereditary!
That was Holly, and I'm Becky. Holly, do you want to say something about the film?
Hereditary! Toni Collette has a lot of problems. Basically, it's kind of a family tragedy psychodrama with satanic cult elements.
I think that sums it up nicely, yeah. I said to you, I read some reviews before today just to see what other people had said about it. And some of the films that I saw people compare it to were things like Don't Look Now and Rosemary's Baby. And I thought those were quite pretty accurate reflections of films that it's similar to in terms of that kind of ordinary is scary kind of things being slightly off kilter, slow burn, psychological horror kind of feeling.
Yeah, and the Rosemary's Baby influence is pretty obvious with the kind of cult and kind of grooming the offspring to be some sort of antichrist.
So stylistically, I thought it was really well shot. It was really beautiful. And it reminded me of Edward Hopper paintings. And you said you thought it was quite Lynchian, like David Lynch.
Yeah, I'd probably say that about everything, but it is. Yeah, in terms of the, like, some of the filming of the interiors and the kind of use of kind of slow transitions between shots and the kind of use of the soundtrack to kind of create unease. Definitely very, very David Lynch kind of bits of, like, Lost Highway, maybe even Inland Empire.
Yeah, the soundtrack is really good. Soundtrack by Colin Stetson. They use sound throughout the film as this sort of creepy way of building atmosphere. Like, it's just a constant, ever-present kind of ominous noise. And then also, there's a, I don't even know what you'd call it, a clipping, clopping mouth noise that one of the characters makes. Do it again? Yeah, I can't do that. I actually can't make that noise. Anyhow, so yeah, one of the characters, Charlie, she makes that noise like a couple of times in the film before she, spoiler alert, dies. And then you begin to hear that noise like everywhere. Mm. And it's a really innocent little noise, but they managed to make it quite terrifying. So whenever you hear it throughout the film, it's like really sinister, which I think is the mark of quite good filmmaking and good sound effects.
Yeah, because I think it's your kind of point of view sound, so it's like it's suddenly in your ear. Like hearing someone, you know, whispering your name isn't inherently scary, but if it's like suddenly right into your ear when you think you're alone, then you're gonna do a poo.
So I also read that the director, Ari Aster, found that this film took quite a long time to make and that there's some kind of personal kind of family instances relayed in this film, but doesn't go into detail about what those may be. But you can definitely feel throughout the film that it's very deeply emotional. It's a lot about family dynamics. There's a lot about the relationship between the mother, the matriarch of the family, and the other members of the family around them. And there's quite a lot about loss and grief.
Yeah.
So those are the kind of the strong themes going throughout the film.
But like our responses to it were quite different, which is interesting, I think.
Yes, definitely interesting for us to discuss how we approached it in different ways. And I wonder if that's to do with, it's to do with us being different humans, sure.
Yeah.
I wonder.
Most certainly.
Yeah. I wonder if it's to do with our different conditions as well. So you found the main character, I suppose she's the main character, Annie, played by Toni Collette, who is the mother of the family. You found her to be kind of annoying. Is that a fair assumption?
Yes, but I mean, we'll kind of talk about this a bit more in terms of the gender dynamics of the film, because I simultaneously feel bad for it, but then also I'm just, my instinct watching it is that she is too much, you know. She's, yeah, just hysterical and constantly flying off the handle, and just like her feelings dominate everything and everyone.
Yeah, I was thinking from Toni Collette's point of view, it must have been quite a hard film to make. She spends a lot of the film in varying different states of emotion. Sometimes she's like really cold and Sometimes she's really cold and dissociated. And other times she's like screaming, proper dramatics, like her face is, you know, contorting this way and that. It must be quite difficult to sort of throw yourself into those different emotional states throughout the film. But she's also a real powerhouse of acting throughout the film as well. Yeah. I think like she's the main vehicle that drives the film through.
Yeah. I mean, she's definitely the focus, but I'm not sure that we're necessarily supposed to like her.
Yes, so you found her kind of an unsympathetic character, and I think that is a fair characterisation. I think she is kind of unsympathetic. But then I also had quite a lot of sympathy with her. So I think the reason that I have sympathy for her is she is an artist who makes these like miniature sort of representations of her own life, kind of tiny doll's houses, but she's making little tableaus of stuff through her life for an upcoming exhibition. And these include the horrible things that she's been through. So at the beginning of the film, her mother has just died. And so she's making a little hospital room with the little image of her mother in the hospital bed and everything. And I, although I don't make tiny miniature houses, which I would love to though, like they're very cool. So although that's not, you know, a hobby of mine, I sort of identified with it because I felt like she's trying to control herself in a situation where she just feels really out of control. Like her family dynamics are not working. She's from this really dysfunctional family and there's a lot going on there and there's a lot of issues which present themselves throughout the film. But I think like her making these tiny little worlds is her kind of trying to have some control. Mm. And as someone who has got OCD, I think that really rung true to me because a lot of my OCD is around trying to control and make sense of a world that I don't have a handle on.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I mean, I think in terms of my anxiety, I certainly seek control and have a lot of routines and things. But I suppose because then we were talking about that I kind of identified with Charlie at some point, and I wondered... Charlie the daughter, yeah. And I wondered whether it was interesting to examine it through the lens of autism, because I feel that she responds to situations in a way that other people find inappropriate or strange. In herself, quite a benign and peaceful person, but she's just being pulled in a lot of different directions by other people's expectations. And yeah, hard relate.
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing that I found sympathetic about the mother is, so I feel like there's a representation of mental health throughout this film. They talk about two other family members who've died from mental health related incidents, and they talk about the mother having had an instance where she sleepwalks and she'd nearly burnt the children to death while sleepwalking, as you do, and that has caused a lot of a rift in her relationship with her son, unsurprisingly, because his mother tried to kill him, which is obviously terrifying. But I feel like throughout the film, she isn't sure if she's going mad, but then also she knows she's not going mad and that it's true, and she's trying to get people to understand her. But she's so overwrought and emotional in the way she represents herself to people that her husband just assumes she has gone mad and just doesn't listen to her and won't give her the time of day because he's so angry and feels like she's not listening, that she needs psychological help. And so I found that really upsetting. Yeah. And I had a lot of sympathy for her because I felt like nobody was listening to her and she just had a genuine point that there was all this crazy demonic stuff happening and no one was helping.
If it had just been the husband versus the wife in terms of like emotional register and responses, then I don't think I would have sympathized with Gabriel Byrne's character, because it kind of, he reminded me a bit of the husband in Antichrist, that he's like, you know, who is actually a psychiatrist and kind of very unethically treating his wife for their shared bereavement. But yeah, that's another very, I wonder if, oh, will we talk about that film sometime, maybe?
Yeah, maybe we should talk about that one, because, yeah, I've definitely got some stuff to say about that film.
But yeah, Gabriel Byrne's character wasn't unsympathetic, but then I felt he did kind of patronize and kind of control her and like shut down all her, it didn't seem plausible that they would ever have connected romantically. And he just
didn't seem much of a relationship between them. No chemistry or love between them.
No, just he was kind of her judgy caretaker, basically.
But I think he has genuine connection and love for the children.
Yeah.
She's not very maternal generally with either of the children. He's the one that has the caring sort of approach.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. You're right about that, actually. Because, yeah, he does seem to be the caretaker.
And I think she's just so divorced from the family, trying to deal with all this stuff going on in her own head, that she's not present within the lives of her family.
Yeah. I mean, I can understand that. And he wants to provide a kind of consistency for the children.
But you sympathised a lot with the son, Peter.
Yeah.
Who is a very sympathetic figure. A lot of stuff is happening to him. But I didn't sympathise with him as much. I kind of got a bit annoyed with him at times. I don't really know why. I mean, he's been through a really horrible time, so I'm not sure why I couldn't kind of identify with him as much. Maybe it's because I was identifying with the mother and they have such a difficult relationship.
Yeah. But, I mean, yeah, like you said, it's completely understandable. The incident that happened would have damaged their relationship, and it frustrated me more that the mother didn't seem to recognise that. She, you know, when she told the story of sleepwalking and things, she was like, well, of course I didn't mean it, and of course I was sleepwalking, but he'll never forgive me now. Like, it was all kind of about her kind of hurt feelings rather than, well, I mean, that's got to come from somewhere. And she actually tells him in the dream that she never wanted him and that she tried to end the pregnancy and things, which, I mean, pro-choice feminists, okay, you know, we're all gravy with that.
But maybe don't tell your child
alive
that you tried to get rid of them.
No.
But I feel I can be okay with not being for.
Yeah.
So pro-choice, not pro telling your child they should have been aborted.
Yeah.
Fair? Yeah. It's not a catchy slogan though, is it?
Yeah. And just how he kind of freezes at the point. I mean, he's very emotional at times and kind of bursts into tears and cries in quite almost like a very raw way. It's almost like a toddler crying because he's just like bellowing. But then Toni Collette's kind of like that as well, actually. She's very uninhibited. But I think a lot of the time it seems like Peter's trying to hold it all inside. There's like really interesting, like after Charlie's death. Well, yeah, immediately after it, the dawning realization on his face, the silence and just the tear running down his face, but just like you see in real time him coming to understand the situation. And then when he's asleep on the sofa and Toni Collette finds the body and we're with him. I mean, she's screaming and screaming in the background, but then it's more I can sympathize with him, like, because he knows that nothing's ever going to be the same again. Because I can see that he hasn't told anyone. He's just come home and slumped on the sofa, but I guess because he just wants to stop time. Because it will, yeah, as soon as his parents find out what's happened, then their lives will never be the same again.
Yeah. I think that's a really well done scene. It's probably the scene that most emotionally impacted me. I think he's in his bed. I think he's gone up to his bed.
Oh, okay.
But I'm not sure. But yeah, it's just, it's on his face. And we can hear her in the background saying she's leaving, she's going to get in the car, she'll be back later. And we know what she's going to find when she gets to the car. And his face is just completely dispassionate the whole time. There's no flicker of like what's about to happen. And then we hear her make the finding of her child's body. And there's this like raw animal guttural screaming, which is really heart-wrenching because you know what she's just seen and you really feel it.
Yeah.
And then the next few scenes continue with her just screaming in various locations at the funeral and, you know, the wake. And there's a lot of emotional outburst whereas his is all contained and quiet. And that juxtaposition, it's really powerful and definitely impactful.
I think that's what I identified with, being more of an introvert and more of a kind of internal in my emotions. It's not that I don't feel things as much, I just don't show as much.
Yeah.
And I've, you know, in my life, I've been drawn to people who are very emotional and demonstrative, but then sometimes you feel like there's no room for any of your feelings.
That's interesting. That is very much what you see in the film, isn't it?
Mm.
There's no room for anyone else's feelings.
Yeah.
It's all about her. And that's what you found really difficult about it, is because it's all about her.
Yeah. Because while her reactions are warranted, you're just like, oh, it's too much. Just enough. Enough. You know, when the grief counselling kind of support group, and she tells the story in a very matter-of-fact way of all the tragedies that have happened to her family that resulted in this situation. And my reading of it was that the rest of the group were just like stunned, and they're just like, fucking hell. But
she comes out with a lot, and yeah, it's just not even in the, she's not like crying her way through it.
Yeah.
She's saying, this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened.
But I don't know, because looking back, I don't know whether they were just neutral, whether they were just listening and neutral, but maybe I was projecting, because I thought they were just like, oh God, well, guess you've had the worst life ever. I guess this is just your group now.
So, remind me not to go to group therapy with you, Jesus. I think in some ways, I think that is giving us the juxtaposition of, she's quite cold and unemotional. And the beginning, as said, is about her mother's funeral. And she talks about, should I be more sad? And she's not really crying and she's not really upset. And she sort of feels guilty. So we were saying before, it reminds us about grief and is there an appropriate, proper way to grieve? But then when her child dies, she goes from being completely on top of her emotions and quite closed to being absolutely hysterical. In some ways, that makes it more visceral because it's just such a difference.
I think, yeah, I think there's a lot about, are we grieving in the right way? Are we expressing the right level of emotion? Not too little, not too much, not at the wrong time. And I think it's very relatable to when you're in that state of grief. You know, you go through many stages, obviously, but, you know, just wondering if you're responding in the right way and comparing yourself to people around you. And of course, everyone's grief is their own.
So we talked a lot about the fact that there's a lot going on here about the dysfunctions within the family and the very crazy dynamics between the family. And the title Hereditary refers to a couple of things. For me, I think it refers to kind of a thread of mental illness that runs through the family, but it also refers to this sort of curse of this kind of demon satanic stuff that is also running through the family as well. But I also think there's another kind of thing that's running through there, is about sort of secrets within the family. None of them saying what they really mean, none of them actually communicating properly as a family. And I think that's the real horror of this, is that so much of this could have been dealt with and avoided if they could have just sat down and had proper conversations with one another. But because they don't, it creates this really tense, cut the atmosphere with a knife kind of difficult place to be.
And kind of boundaries, and in a way, like through Annie, everyone's feelings are subordinated and interlinked. Everyone has to feel everything she feels constantly. But then the others have responded to such an extent that they're completely shut down.
So it's definitely a psychological horror. Obviously, there's the satanic links. But there's no monster. There's not a lot of blood and gore. I said there's a couple of really horrific things that you see, but they are just like short, sharp shocks. It's not sustained. There's not a lot of blood throughout the film, and, you know, it's not overly gory. The horror is very much in the stuff that you don't really see. And I suspect, although this is the second time I've watched it now, I suspect if I watched it again thinking about this, you probably see even less than I think you do, because of the way they've kind of structured it. And so much stuff is just creepy, even though it's not actually that scary.
I thought it was terrifying. I saw it in the cinema and I was absolutely cacking it. It reminded me a bit of when I saw Inland Empire by David Lynch in the cinema. It's just a kind of constant atmosphere of wrongness. You don't know what's going to happen, but it's not going to be good.
Yeah.
Also recently when I watched that Netflix series Marianne, did you watch that?
Yes, yeah, I watched that as well. I agree with you that there's a lot of, it's that things that seem strange, but you can't really put your finger on why they seem strange, and then suddenly they're horrific.
Would it be a good time to compare this film to Midsommar, the other film by Ari Aster?
Yes, I think it would. I think it's really interesting that these films are by the same director. I think you can tell that they're by the same director in some way.
Oh, yeah.
But I also think that they're also very different films. Just even in the way they're shot, there's really different kind of choices about the films, which I find really interesting. I probably loved Midsommar more than I loved this film.
Mm.
And I was probably more disturbed by Midsommar than I was this film. But I know that that's probably not the case for a lot of people based on the general reviews that I read.
Yeah, it's kind of the opposite. I mean, I feel like I definitely need to watch Midsommar again because it was certainly a very interesting film. It didn't really scare me. I mean, it was kind of, some of the body horror stuff was a bit like, but it was just more kind of just intriguing and odd. Had a, like, more of a weird humour to it as well, which was very unexpected.
Yeah, it did. There's a lot more lightness to it. But I found that overall, to me, that film felt more oppressive and terrifying, and that stayed with me for a much longer time than this film. And I didn't feel as scared by this film, which is quite interesting.
That is interesting, because I mean, I definitely found that I related to Florence Pugh's character in Midsommar a lot more than Annie, Tanya Nicolette, in this film. But I mean, she's also like the emotional centre of the film, but then she's almost... she's a lot more interior. And the whole thing is that people in her life don't allow her to express her emotions. You know, her boyfriend is very gaslighting and minimizing. And then this cult kind of allows, in Midsommar, allows her to kind of finally share her emotions in a kind of communal outpouring of woe, which is, yeah, quite empowering in a way.
Whereas I hated that scene. So we,
oh, really?
Yeah, we've talked about this before, where you said you think that, you know, that should be like some kind of mandated thing where we all get together and like scream our woes out simultaneously. And it's like, that is the single most horrific scene. I just can't think of anything worse.
No, I think my idea was for like primal goat therapy, where you just, everyone's just like with a load of goats and just going, ah!
I mean, I'm all for that, especially if they're goats in pyjamas. That's a thing you need to look up now. What? Seriously.
Oh.
It's a video.
Did I look like I didn't understand what you were talking about?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm all about the goats.
Goats in pyjamas. Definitely look it up. I filled many a bad day with that video.
Oh, that sounds lovely. I wonder, he would definitely be an interesting comparison with Lars von Trier in terms of that he is a male director that centres female characters and female suffering and emotion in his work, but then is it in some ways has an overly cool directorial style. So it's like, are we supposed to be sympathizing with the people, or are they just being used as kind of like a effect?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting. In both of those films, there's no overt sexualizing, even though in Midsommar there is some sexual scenes that take part as part of a ritual. None of it is done for titillation. There's no like tits out kind of titillation stuff. It's
alas.
Alas, indeed. It's all just kind of like general women being women.
Gals being pals.
Yeah, gals being, exactly. But I think there is something about, in both cases, they're well drawn out women. They're well drawn out characters. They're not one dimensional characters at all. There's a richness to both characters. But I do think there is perhaps an over-reliance on the hystericalness of the women that I find a little bit irksome.
Yeah. I mean, I feel it's kind of using that as a trope, but it will, yeah, it would kind of, is that the only way to talk about complex emotional women, even if you're subverting the trope of the hysterical woman? Is there, you know, do we need it? So men having more of a range of emotions, might that be more progressive?
Exactly. I think it would be a really interesting film to see both of those films with the male character being centred. I think that would be potentially a very different kind of film, but it would be interesting to see. I do enjoy having rich female characters, I can't deny.
Yeah, definitely. So I think a big part of the horror in this film comes from our natural revulsion as humans, and probably a lot of other animals as well, towards corpses. I mean, there's like a theory that that's a kind of biological imperative, because corpses often attract
disease.
Yes. So as we want to get rid of our dead fairly soon and out of the way of foodstuffs and watercourses.
Yeah, that's what I do with my corpses. I walk them away from my food and drink areas.
Of course, you've got to separate them.
Yeah, different coloured chopping boards.
You must not use the same board for your raw corpses as your cooked corpses.
Jeffrey Dahmer's School of Cooking. There's flies. There's just a lot of flies in this film, because the flies are symbolising the decay and the death. On some level, you could see that as the sort of decay and the death of the family as well. But I think, as you say, there is something around, like, adding to that inability to deal with grief properly, is inability to accept and deal with death and bodies.
Because there's a real kind of tension between the very sanitized, sentimentalized kind of rituals of grief and like the bodily realities of death. It's a point of unease in the film that Charlie doesn't have that revulsion towards corpses, that she kind of picks up the bird and cuts off the head, and that she's openly staring at the body of the grandmother just while eating a chocolate bar.
Yeah. Her natural curiosity, which children often have, a natural curiosity for dead things, because they haven't learnt that dead things are to be feared yet.
I mean, I've never seen a dead body, but I know, like, in some cultures, that's a lot more normalised, to the idea of a kind of open casket funeral and things.
So in the film, they have an open casket funeral. I think that's quite common in America, isn't it?
Right.
In Wales, in the rural areas where I'm from, it used to be much more common to have the dead body in your home, to sit around, and also in Jewish faith, that's often quite a common thing to do. If you speak to any, because I'm Welsh, if you speak to any Welsh or Irish people, I think we have a generally different view of death. It's kind of almost more of an entire community event rather than just a death. Not quite a celebration, but also a celebration.
Yeah.
Whereas I think, I'm generalising now, obviously, but I think in England, people deal with death in a very different way to how I have observed it being dealt in the way I've been brought up.
Yeah, very private and subdued affair.
Yeah, and it's always interesting, isn't it, when you see different death rituals and death cultures. I mean, I could talk for hours about this, but from different countries where you might see people wailing, openly wailing at the graveside, and, you know, that's sort of normalized and you'll see everyone doing it, or where you might see people having like death processions where it's like a party and everybody's involved. And there are lots of different ways and rituals around death, but the ones that we have adopted in a generally westernized culture, as you say, are much more kind of like private and contained and composed, and there does seem to be a sense of the right and wrong ways to approach it, which very much touches on the themes of this film about loss, grief, and the guilt around not doing it the way that you should do.
Definitely.
So the other thing that we both picked up on is that the actress that plays Charlie, she has a disability. Remind me what it's called.
I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it, but cleidocranial dysplasia,
which you told me is the same disability that the boy from Stranger Things has.
Yes, Gaydon Matarazzo.
They don't mention it. At no point throughout the film do they mention it, but she has a fairly obvious physically facial disability, and they just kind of make her seem odd and creepy throughout the film, slightly unusual. I think some of this is achieved, I was thinking about it, she just wears this sweatshirt that is just several sizes too big as well. And there are just things about that that just make her look unusual. And all of those kind of things add up to this picture of her being unusual. And you later find out why this is. But that made both of us feel uncomfortable, because there's this kind of use of somebody with a disability to be something that's scary, which on one hand doesn't feel like a very politically correct thing to do, for sure. It feels a bit uncomfortable, even though it's not explicit.
Yeah, because I mean, I had quite a lot of sympathy for her as a character. Yeah, again, I don't know how much of that was work done by me, because then other people would be like, oh yeah, that film with that creepy kid that makes the noises. And yeah, and it's definitely so different from the character in Stranger Things, who is just kind of similar facial features.
I mean, obviously, that's a lighter program. It's more comical.
Well, in some ways.
Audience.
I mean, it's got a lot of horror in as well, but he's just a kid, and he's quite matter-of-fact about it, and like people, kids tease him, and then he's just like, no, I've got this condition, and you know, it means that these parts don't develop, and...
Yeah, and that's, it doesn't play a part in the series, and it's not used to make him othered or different in any way, whereas in this, she is very much othered.
Well, I think because it's quite strongly implied that she has some sort of learning difference. I mean, and then you'd suggested that she was always possessed by the demon. So that was just the demon in human form. But I didn't necessarily always feel that.
Yeah, so it's hard to know. It's hard to know the director's intentions and how much of that, as you say, is our kind of projections or us thinking about it in a different light. It doesn't feel, I have to say, it doesn't feel like a comfortable thing to do or a responsible thing to do where the character that's creepy has a disability. Like, that just doesn't feel like the right thing to do.
It does feel like that she was cast because of her facial features.
Yeah.
And then othered in quite a lot of ways through the characterization. You know, I haven't seen that young actor in anything else. I mean, maybe she's done loads of stuff, but...
Yeah, she's done other things, yeah.
Okay, good. Non-creepy things?
Non-creepy things, but I think after this film, once she was known. So, to round it up, to end, I would say that I thought it was a really good film. I enjoyed it as much as you enjoy a horror film. I think it's much more of a psychological horror. I don't think I particularly was scared by this film. I was unnerved and unsettled by this film, but I didn't feel scared by it. But I did feel that it was like a really good portrait of kind of the disintegration of a family that lacks the ability to communicate, but has a lot of secrets.
Yeah, it's interesting because compared to last time on It Follows, that scared me again. And I thought, oh, this is a good film. But this, I felt like I went through the same emotions again. And it was really gut-wrenching. And I remembered. There was no softening of the blow. And it just felt so kind of emotionally grueling and kind of upsetting. But I had to kind of work up to it.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking forward to the non-COVID times where one day we might be able to watch these films together so we can go through the experience together instead of watching them remotely in our own little bubbles.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely, that'd be lovely.
One day. All right, so that is it from us for episode 2. Thank you very much for listening. Please do follow us on our social media. We are on Instagram and Twitter at Panic Pixies, and also on Facebook as Panic Pixie Scream Girls. We would love to hear from you. And if there's any films that you think we should cover, do suggest them to us.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Till next time. Bye.
Bye.
You were listening to a podcast by the Panic Pixie Scream Girls, who are Holly Parsons and Becky Lewis-Jones. This podcast was edited by Gareth Lewis-Jones.